greatness, Buzz, isn't easy to define. I can say to you, what did you think of that match? And you say it was a great match. But I really don't know what you're talking about, except to say that you enjoyed it. And what we're trying to do today is set up some boxes that our listeners can tick in anticipation of when they're watching a match next time to say, this match should be great. Bring the popcorn in, I'm putting my feet up, and let's go. Buzz, can I tell you what my fear is?
Please.
And it's not the one about opening the wardrobe and finding my father dressed as a clown, huddled in the corner, weeping. That's for another time. My fear with what we're about to do here is trying to analyse and pull apart match greatness. Are we going to be destroying the magic somehow?
I know what you mean, because when you take something apart, are you destroying the essence of what makes it special in order just to look at it scientifically?
Exactly. And what are we left with? We've discovered what it is, but we don't feel it any longer. That's my fear, but I'm not going to let that stop us because I think we
owe it. Well, maybe it should. Good night, everyone.
No, just pull it back, son. When you're watching a great match, and you've watched a lot, what is your body telling you?
More often than not that I'm hungry. What is my body telling me?
When you're sitting there watching a great match, you're loving it, but there's something happening inside you, right?
There's a tension that rises and there's an excitement, a little bit of nausea. What are you getting at with this?
In essence, I've got this idea that there's almost like a transference occurring from what's going on in the match somehow is transferring itself into your body. There's a connection. You with me?
I think I'm with you, but keep going.
Well, it's this whole notion of we want to so badly connect with what we're seeing. We want to be part of it. It's almost like a bond. When you've watched a great match, you remember it for a long time. It almost becomes like part of your family.
Okay, so what you're saying is that when you're watching a great match, you're identifying so closely with the people who are playing.
I've actually substituted the 2008 Wimbledon final for an uncle that I can't stand. Just as an example.
I know him. He had it coming.
Sure did. I guess really just to dig a little deeper, what is it at that point in a great match, and again, we've all experienced this, that causes a crowd almost in unison to get up off their seats together and start applauding, a standing ovation. You know that moment?
Yeah,
it erupts spontaneously and it almost happens simultaneously.
It does, it does. There's also that moment where they will roar at the same time. It's a guttural thing.
When is it appropriate to give a standing ovation and when is it appropriate just to sit and applaud? You know that whole thing I've got that there needs to be something in between.
Oh, I know. I know very, very
well. Yes, I call it the crouching ovation.
There are not enough crouching ovations.
Well, no. And you know that I've received various funding from different government bodies to develop this whole idea.
And they say this country's going to the dogs.
Well, and we've tried it. We've tried the crouching ovation. Admittedly, it wasn't at a tennis match. It was at the opera where we were there. Some people were standing and applauding. And most people were sitting and we were there with our backsides up off the chair, crouching and applauding. And we held that position, I think, for too long because somebody eventually called security and we rejected. But I still believe that there's a place for the crouching ovation.
It's sundown, Remo. It's sundown.
My favourite time of the day.
And why? Because at opposite ends of that tennis court, you've got two players who want to take each other down. That's what tennis is about. Winning, getting over the top. You can't wait out a tennis match. You have to win it. There's no draws. So a tennis match is about one player getting on top of the other player. Now, in this section, we're going to talk about rivalries, great rivalries. How many tennis matches are played each year on both circuits, men's and women's, and yet there are some rivalries and some matches that you just look out for. When they say, oh, it's Federer Nadal, the ratings go through the roof. So if the level of talent and ability is the same or close, even though they might have wildly different styles, then that can contribute to a great match.
You're right. If there's a gulf between the number one and the two player in the world, that's a problem, right?
Yep.
Because if from two to number 100 sit behind the number one player, it really doesn't matter when one plays two, if there's that gulf. So it looks like it should be a rivalry, but it isn't. When does that happen? I can think on the women's side of some notable phases. When Graf, for example, was just dominating, Navratilova, Evert, where they were just running through tournaments, and you'd be thinking, well, who's the number two player here? And it wasn't making much difference.
That's right. It was interchangeable.
And the first thing that people come up with is, she needs a rival. He needs a rival. So we're always crying out for a rival.
There's something about seeing two players that are evenly matched, and evenly matched in different ways, because there's a talent level. I think there's also an ambition level and a self-belief level. A lot of talented players out there who will never reach the top because they don't have the self-belief or that strong burning ambition to be number one. And when you've got two players who are going for that mantle, who have equally strong ambition and belief and talent, then that's the jackpot, because those matches are going to be played on a much, much higher level. And that can combust in the match itself, I think.
So you're talking about intensity in the rivalry. And that's an interesting point, because if we look at Borg and McEnroe,
yeah,
only one of those parties is who you would describe as being intense, and that's McEnroe. But you watch a match, McEnroe and Borg, it feels like an intense match, and you would say that all the heat is coming from one side of the court, because Borg was the way he was, no matter who he played. Laver and Roseball, another great rivalry in tennis,
yeah,
two very placid, laid-back guys. They get on a court and the rivalry there is fueled by other things, closeness of talent, intense, but not what you would call extrovert types.
No, that's
so
right.
So there's a difference. Again, with Evert and Navratilova, same deal. Navratilova was very emotional, very highly strung. Yeah. Evert was like Borg, but it didn't matter. You don't need two intense players on the court at the same time.
Well, it's interesting you talk about intense, because you're talking about an overt intensity on the court in terms of the way they're acting, the way they're behaving. But there's also an intensity of will. I think for both those players that you mentioned, Borg and Evert, had incredible intensity of will.
Mm.
They didn't act it out on court in terms of behaviour, but in terms of their steeliness and what they wanted to achieve, that was unwavering. So I think that's also part of it, where that intensity of will and determination doesn't necessarily have to come out in behaviour, but it's, you can feel it.
Mm.
You can feel it with Borg all the time. I mean, it was there. And when it wasn't there, that was the end of Borg.
Do you think any of these players that we've been talking about acted very differently off court to the way they did on court?
Well, I think the great example is Rafa Nadal.
Mm.
On court, the most intense guy, and Roger Federer has said that, and that's obviously one of the great rivalries in tennis history, that on court he's incredibly intense, off court a really soft-hearted guy.
Mm.
Really interesting. That white, it's almost like white line fever. Once you get on that court and cross that white line, you turn into a different person.
It's interesting and almost the opposite to what you're saying. And I read this in an article the other day with Marin Cilic, one of the most placid men on court. You play a round of canasta with him, you're coming to blows after about 3 minutes. It's interesting, isn't it?
Cilic and canasta. That just doesn't mix, like petrol and water.
I think it's fascinating, the whole opposites thing. And it's style of play, appearance. Does it extend to anything else, Buzz, like even outside of the court, for example?
What you've nominated there, appearance and style of play, they're the obvious things because you see them on court.
Yes. Like, is it how you comport yourself in the dressing room before the match? Do opposites extend to everything?
Well, we don't see that.
Mm.
That's the thing. Like, food choices.
Does Nadal take a shower? Federer's a bath man.
Wouldn't surprise me. These are the things we don't know.
Mm.
But does that feed into the rivalry? And do they know about these things?
Did they look at each other and go, well, if he's ordering the lasagna, I'm going the cannelloni? I don't know. Does it become almost like a mental thing?
Yeah. You know, Roger Federer's bought himself a Labrador. Forget that. I'm going to buy a cat. That kind of thing.
That's right. And that's the sort of thing Nadal would do, because we know that Nadal has a great fear of dogs.
He has. It's well documented.
Very well documented. So exactly. So that's the sort of thing that maybe Federer would flaunt his Labrador in front of Nadal.
It's more specific. Nadal actually has a fear of tails. So he bought a tailless cat. It's not actually a cat. I don't think they've told him this.
And it just sits there.
Just sits
on
there
his bed.
Looks at him morosely.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship.
Next on our list is the occasion. So these are the moments when players are playing for all the marbles. So we're talking Grand Slam finals, Davis Cup finals, Fed Cup finals, matches that might be deciding a 1 and 2 ranking. Something that comes to mind in the 70s were those winner-take-all matches that Connors played against Laver and Newcombe, right, where there was $1 million going. Anything where there's something up for grabs, where we come to the match with a sense of expectation and anticipation that there's something on the line here. Doesn't always make the match great, but if it turns into a great match, we're all conscious that there's something at stake here. It's all feeding in, is what I'm trying to say.
I think there's also different quality to these different occasions. I think there's a difference between a Davis Cup final. The anticipation as a spectator, for example, with the Wimbledon final, I think is different than the Australian Open final. There's a subtle gradation between them, I think, because it's just a different feeling of the actual tournaments. Not that one's necessarily any more important than the other one. I suppose Wimbledon is the most important. But there's just a different feeling to all these occasions when you go to sit down and watch them. You know, the Olympics final, the end of year ATP finals, different feeling again, but still setting up there for a great match. You see, okay, Djokovic is playing Federer in the final. I'm going to watch that because this is an occasion. You know, whatever. It could be anyone, actually. It doesn't have to be even just that rivalry we talked about.
Yes, so it draws you in, certainly, but that's not to say, for example, that you could be watching the first round of the Merle Scranton Open and be captivated. You could be watching a Wimbledon final that bores you to tears. But, yeah, it's this whole sense of occasion. And one thing I want to bring up here is I think that's the reason why we are so highly critical, maybe overly critical, of some big matches, matches that we expect to be great, but it hasn't quite lived up to our sense of expectation.
Exactly right. And the actual occasion has lifted the expectation, hasn't it?
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. We've been spoiled in the men's game, particularly in the last 15 years, because we've got these three greats, and with Andy Murray as well. But there have been a lot of, for example, Wimbledon finals. Was this, you know, Sampras versus Cedric Pioline? I think that was one. I mean, that's...
Well, tell me what you remember outside of the streaker with the Malavai Washington and Krejcik final.
I remember the streaker.
Well, there's a pretty sight. Escorted off the field of play by... Well, we've had all sorts of firsts here this year.
We're going to look at three matches in particular here, Buzz.
Three?
Three great matches. And the first one we want to look at is a first round match.
There you go.
Saying, first round match? Really? Yes, a first round match at Wimbledon in 1969 between the venerable Poncho Gonzalez and a young Charlie Passerell. Gonzalez, I think, was 41 at the time. Passerell was in his late 20s. And this match went for 5 hours and 12 minutes, 112 games played over 2 days. Here's the kicker, though, I think, especially when we compare it to the next match that we're going to talk about. The match went for 5 hours and 12 minutes and there were no sit-downs. Remember that. So that's very different to the next match between Djokovic and Nadal that we're going to talk about.
So at the changeover, they didn't sit down. Did they have a little break at all, or was it just walking around the net post?
It was pretty much walking around the net post, quickly taking a drink, putting the drink down and walking through. So I don't know how many seconds that would have taken, but that is condensed. That 5 hours and 12 minutes that I'm talking about is a very condensed period of time. So it's very different to the match we're going to compare. And I think that gets forgotten when we talk about the epics of today.
If you added the sit-down time, that'd add so much on with all those games.
Yeah.
Oh. So that's, you've got to think, that's 112, did you say, games? So that's 56 changeovers, roughly.
Yeah.
You know, and you add a couple of minutes on, that's an extra few hours.
Yeah, now that's a side issue, but this was a great match. Besides the drama of the match ending in darkness, Gonzalez getting angry, kicking the back of the umpire's chair, storming off, Passerell had 7 match points. Gonzalez won the match. And in the final set, he was down love 40 twice, served his way out of trouble. You know when those moments happen in a match and you just takes your breath away?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like a wave after wave. So it was a wonderful match, first round match, and he was honoured in the press afterwards. People were just praising the match.
41. It's incredible. Now, this is 1969, so this is pre-tiebreaker, isn't it?
That's right.
Wow. So
tiebreakers at Wimbledon 71, I believe.
What was the biggest number of games in a set in that one?
In this one, it was 22 to 24. Passerelle won that set.
That's a long set.
That's a great. Well, you ain't seen nothing. Wait till we get to Isner and Mahut.
Which set was it?
That was the first set.
The first set was 24-22. I just would have hung up my racket and said, see you later, folks, I'm out of here.
Well, Gonzalez almost did because he lost the second set in protesting against the light, 6-1.
Right.
He wanted the match stopped.
So he was down two sets to love.
That's right. That's right. He came back and won the next three sets.
That's incredible.
Great match. A great match.
Okay, now you want to compare this to the famous Djokovic-Nadal epic of 2012 at the Australian Open final.
That's right.
Which just seemed to go on forever.
Did.
Do you remember in the presentation ceremony afterwards, they were standing there and you could see they were uncomfortable. They had to bring them chairs, but it took the Australian Open organisers a while to twig that these guys were out on their feet.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was 5 hours and 53 minutes. But that's with your sit-downs, and I know that they're playing at a higher physical level.
Yeah.
But then I think back to Gonzalez and Passerelle with the equipment they were using. Isn't it easier today with modern equipment to hit a tennis ball than with the basic aluminium or wooden rackets?
In terms of energy expenditure, you mean?
Yeah,
I think it would be. The other side of it, of course, is that they've actually measured the speed. Tennis today is played twice as fast.
Let's look at why that match was great between Nadal and Djokovic. Number one and two were playing at the time.
Yep.
So ticks that box. The level of physicality, that match is spoken about in those terms, in terms of raw physicality, the effort of the two players that night.
Yeah, we know those two players are renowned for that kind of effort, and it's particularly Nadal, it's sort of the gladiator comparisons with him.
Yeah, yeah. But what it did also put a spotlight on was the time both players took in between points.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm making this analogy, this comparison with the Passerelle and Gonzalez match.
Yeah. You're not just talking about changeovers, you're talking about in between individual points in the games themselves.
Yes.
I mean, Djokovic used to bounce a ball about 123 times each time he served. That used to drive everyone crazy. And we know Nadal, his stretching of the time continuum when it comes to in between points. I mean, he's still renowned for it. People are still complaining to this day about it, even with the time clocks.
Well, they are. And all sorts of crazy talk.
Did I say time clocks?
Yes, you did.
Is that what it's called? A time clock? That doesn't sound right. What is it called?
A shock clock or a shot clock?
It's a time clock. I mean, what else is a clock? It's not a, you know, that's not a, I don't know, what would you call it? A weight clock? It's a time clock.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry I brought this up. Anyway, go on, please.
What was I saying? There was all sorts of crazy talk going on after that match because it did bring up a lot of issues that people wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Other than the fact it was a great match, and it was intense, it was gripping, but there was some dissent from people saying, was it really a great match? When you start dissecting some of these other aspects, and there was one idea came out that perhaps in the finals of slams, do the players need valets or butlers to speed things along, take some of the duties away from the ball kids? For example, where the players are sitting down, the change of ends, a butler would grab them while they're in the chair, run them to the baseline to save some time. In the case of Djokovic, maybe the valet would bounce the ball for Djokovic.
And hand it to Djokovic.
While he's preparing himself in other ways to try and somehow cut down on the double up of time.
Yeah. And yet it was only, what, about 15 years before we had the Sampras-Ivanisevic Wimbledon final, which was the exact opposite, where Sampras and Ivanisevic were serving out of their heads and it was like 38 seconds of tennis in the whole match. And so they had to slow Wimbledon down.
Yeah, the highlight reel was 3 seconds.
They ended up slowing down Wimbledon, the actual surface. The other idea was to put them into deep sea diving outfits.
Okay, well, I want to come to the granddaddy of all epics now.
The granddaddy.
Oh, okay, we are, of course, talking about the 2010 Wimbledon, another first-round match. We started with a first-round match between Passerell and Gonzalez, and we're going to end this section, the first-round match between Nicholas Mahut and John Isner. Strap yourself in while I lay some of these stats on you. 11 hours and 5 minutes, played over 3 days. The second day, I believe, was played via correspondence because both of them couldn't make it. Over 3 days, won by Isner, 6-4, 3-6, 6-7, 7-6.
Can I just stop you there?
You want to nominate the last set?
No, I just want to say, up to now, normal tennis match. Pretty normal. Now, what was the last set there, Remo?
Well, the last set was 70-68. The longest match in tennis history. And I'll admit, I haven't seen this match. I haven't watched this match. I have no desire to watch this. And I have nothing against Nicholas Mahut or John Isner.
No.
But I have no desire to want to watch this match in any way, shape or form.
So the question I have for you, these other two matches were great matches. Was this a great match?
I don't know. It was certainly spoken about.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, if you watch the first few sets, I don't think it would have been a great match. It would have been just, okay, this is a good match against two fairly evenly matched competitors. Mm. And the interest would only have risen in the fifth set as it got to 6-all, 7-all, 8-all. And they must have been just holding their serve continually. I mean, Isner has got a massive serve, and that's his weapon. Mm. You've got to think he's not being broken. It must be Mahut who held his serve and held his nerve for that long.
Well, is it holding in nerve or is it something else? Are these two men the two most stubborn individuals in the history of the world? I mean, you think about it.
Of the world?
Well, hang on.
I was going to say tennis, but the world.
Yes, 70-68. Let's just put ourselves into this fifth set, okay? And imagine ourselves to be there. Various points, 10-9 in the fifth set, 22-21 in the fifth set, 36-35 in the fifth set, 58-57 in the fifth set. At this point, surely one of them would be thinking, I got to get the hell out of this match. But no, 65-64 in the fifth set. Finally, we get to 70-68. They hung in there, both of them, like dogs with a bone.
But they didn't know it was going to get to 70-68. So, as for example, at 27-26, you'd have to be thinking, this is going to be over soon. One of us has got to go.
Yeah, okay, but what about at 49-48, where you go, 20 games ago, I thought this was going to be over, I'm bailing.
Well, I have to cancel my dinner reservations, for one.
You have to cancel your family holiday. But I'm going to take you back. You said, who's thought that this was a great match? There is one man on the record who did think this was a great match. That was the umpire. Mohamed Leani said he was gripped by the amazing match. This is the man in the umpire's chair who watched the whole thing. He was gripped.
I don't want an umpire to be gripped. Well, I want him to be adjudicating fairly.
Well, hang on. Is it humanly possible to be gripped by anything for 11 hours? That's my question.
I mean, with Leahani, the man likes to be gripped.
In a professional sense,
of course,
only.
Yeah, of course.
But for 11.
If you're listening, Mohammed, I'm sorry.
For 11 hours and 5 minutes, he must have been tripping at this point.
Well, I wonder if he was watching.
He was seeing something else.
It was probably over at 14-12, but the guys were too tired to understand.
And he's saying, why are all the people still watching and why are the players still playing? But there was something almost hallucinogenic, has to be, going on to the 11th hour of a match that ends up 70-68.
I don't want to watch the match. I want to watch Leahani's head for the last half hour just to see what he's thinking.
Wimbledon has actually released footage of Leahani's head, and you can watch this for 11 hours and 5 minutes, and it's more entertaining than the match. I can tell you, I have watched it, and I tell you, it is worth following up. It's on the Wimbledon channel.
Leahani's head?
That's right, and it's in close-up. A couple of shots there from the back, just to break it up a little bit, but it's a gripping viewing. And I just want to end this section, Buzz, by saying that enough time can create something out of nothing.
You know, at this moment, it's just really painful, but like John said, it was just amazing to play today. We played the greatest match ever and the greatest place to play tennis. You know, Wimbledon is the greatest tournament and we just played the greatest match ever.
The fourth round of the men's singles at Wimbledon in 2001 pitted two of the greatest exponents of the game against each other in what would be their only competitive match. At 29 years of age, America's Pete Sampras was the number one seed and aiming to become the first man ever to win 8 Wimbledon singles titles. Roger Federer was only 19 and seeded 15th. The Swiss was a former junior Wimbledon champion with huge potential, but it was his first appearance in the fourth round and his first appearance on centre court. On paper, it was difficult to see how he could put a stop to Sampras's 31-match winning streak.
Now, this is one of my favourites, Buzz. When worlds collide. I love this whole notion of when there's an intergenerational meeting at the crossroads between an established champion and the person who's going to be the next great champion, even though, of course, at the time, we're not aware of it. It's only later that these matches become apparent. And are they great matches? Often they are. We just heard some audio there on the Sampras-Federer 2001 fourth round match where Federer defeated Sampras, and it's deemed one of the great matches. If Federer never goes on to do another thing after that match, sure, he still beats Sampras, but is it any more notable than George Bastl beating Sampras
at
Wimbledon?
No, it isn't.
And that whole, So in hindsight, does the match become great? Is it a great match? Is it just a good match? But because of the raised status of the up-and-comer, do we then deem it that was a great match?
In that instance of Federer-Sampras, I think it was a great match.
Mm.
Sampras was going for his fifth Wimbledon, remember, to equal Borg. He'd won three, he'd lost one at Wimbledon, and then he'd won four in a row and he's going for his fifth. He wasn't quite the same Sampras and people knew it.
Mm.
Federer had a bit of a buzz about him as a youngster, but he certainly wasn't the Federer you know now. He was a young pup.
Yes.
It wasn't the sort of match, though, where you were going, oh, I'm really looking forward to this.
No.
So in hindsight, it's taken on
yes.
a much greater mantle than it had at the time. It was still a very, very good match.
Mm.
Was it a great match? It's a very good question. Still an excellent, excellent tennis match.
Yeah.
Now, it's one of those markers.
Most certainly. There's lots of these matches in the history of tennis.
Yeah.
Lots of them. Longlin and Helen Wills, Budge, Kramer, Navratilova, Graf, Margaret Court, Chris Evert. I think that may have been a semi-final in the 71 US Open. In hindsight, you look back and go, wow, as you're saying, these are markers, Agassi and Connors.
Well, one's on the way out and one's on the way in.
And you know what it is, on a more basic level when you look at it? It's someone trying to take away something that somebody has held for quite a long time and in high regard. And that's what it almost is. There's the upstart coming in saying, time to pass that over, bud. It belongs to me now.
The one I would say, the Navratilova-Graf match, there was such a buzz about Graf because remember when she came out, she was destroying the opposition.
Oh, yeah.
So by the time she played Navratilova for the first time, there was a buzz about that one. I think everyone knew this was going to be something.
Yes, you're right there. That's a little different to some of the other examples where we didn't know at the time. I'm guilty, though, Buzz, of going back and watching some of these matches. Maybe it's my own sense of expectation. I love these matches and I assign some kind of greatness to them because I'm wrapped up in the history of it. To me, it's quite momentous.
Well, it's the history, but it's also the personalities, the greatness of these players. And you sort of hold them up almost like these Greek gods or Greek statues.
Have you come to pray to the gods, Jason?
If I had, I wouldn't have chosen a fallen one.
Only a statue. Sometimes the gods argue amongst themselves. Then great winds blow and temples fall.
This is the unexpected. Twists and turns. So by its very nature, it's hard to define. Let's have a look at a few of these, Remo. The underdog. comes good. Great theme in sport. Who doesn't go for the underdog? Unless you have some sort of emotional investment with a star player.
Or a personal investment if you've laid a bet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Financial investment.
Oh, yeah.
Then you often will go for the underdog.
And I reckon even sometimes when you've laid your money on the champ and the underdog is coming through, there's a part of you thinking, well, you know what? I'm going to lose my money.
In this sort of situation, the underdog kind of wins you over as you're watching because you're not expecting them to do anything. And they're playing often out of their head, above their capacity, what you thought they were capable of, and they're showing a steeliness and a will to win. And often the great players get into other players' heads. And what they're saying is, no, I'm not going to take this today. I'm just going to go for it.
The most famous, and in a sense, it's not quite along the lines of what you're talking about. You're talking about a player who perhaps the style we don't quite fall in love with. They're playing an ugly brand of tennis and somehow gets into the head of a champ.
Yeah.
And it's hard for that sort of player sometimes to get you on board. But I think you look past that because you're looking at the big picture here and thinking, this person, you know, ranked outside of the top 100, looks like taking down the number one player in the world. And that's exciting enough in itself, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
But the example that we're going to discuss is Connors Ash Wimbledon 1975, the final, where Arthur Ashe was one of the longest odds underdogs in the history of Wimbledon. He was so far out of the ballpark in terms of betting, but public sentiment was on his side.
I mean, let's just set the scene here. In 74, Connors had his breakout year and it was unbelievable. He brought a power to the game that hadn't been seen before and he was running through players. He almost won the Grand Slam. So coming into Wimbledon 75, he was a lock. People thought there was no way he was going to lose this.
Yep. What was most amazing about this match was the way Arthur Ashe had to totally retool his game to win this match.
Yeah.
Play against his instincts. Ashe was a power player, took a lot of risks with his play. On this day, he totally changed his natural instincts and came up with a game plan that dismantled the Connors power game, basically by chipping, dicing, lobbing. Still played aggressively when the moment called for it too, though. Yes. I've heard that Arthur Ashe said if Connors had beaten him that day, he believes that Bjorn Borg wouldn't have got his foot through the door because he believes that would have been enough for Connors' self-belief to keep him going. Yeah, and now that's what he said. I don't know about that. That's a big call. But he thinks that Connors was shaken after that and
sure
his confidence had been knocked.
I mean, one thing about that match, and I think we may have discussed this before, is that Ashe played against his natural instincts and he played a much more defensive style in a way, a much more canny style perhaps is the best way of saying it. And it was only a year before that Muhammad Ali had done the rope-a-dope. And we'd always wondered whether, and no, we has there's no record of him ever talking about this. Where
interesting.
Yeah, whether Ashe saw that and was influenced by that. Because, you know, famous rope-a-dope where against George Foreman, who was going to pummel Ali, everyone thought he might kill him, Ali just went back on the ropes and let Foreman punch himself out. Now, it's a little bit different, but the sentiment's sort of the same, really.
You can certainly draw a parallel there. It's two athletes making a very, very brave move in terms of strategy. Huge.
Absolutely.
Huge.
I mean, against their instinct, against their muscle memory, against everything,
Imagine today if Djokovic decided to play the final of a Grand Slam serving and volleying.
Yeah.
It's tantamount.
Yeah, it's equivalent.
It's similar, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So certainly worthy of a mention in terms of the underdog comes good. Great match.
Very
great
famous match. Around that, there's also times when the great champions are put to the sword and it looks like they're going out. It's all over. And you think, wow, we didn't see that coming. And yet by their fingernails, they escape.
The crowd that gathered at Milton Centre Court in Brisbane on Saturday, January 25, witnessed an epic semi-final between the master, Rod Laver, and his apprentice, Tony Roach.
We're fortunate enough to be joined by a man who needs no introduction. I am, of course, talking about Teddy Shingles. I'd like to invite Teddy here to talk to us about the greatest match he has ever seen, and he's pretty much seen all the matches that we've talked about today, but the one that he's nominated, the 1969 Australian Open semi-final, played between Tony Roach and the great Rod Laver. A match that went for 4 hours and 40 minutes was won by Laver 7-5, 22-20, 9-11, 1-6, 6-3. That's a great match you've chosen, Teddy, and thank you for coming in to talk to us about it.
Absolutely, my pleasure, Reno, my pleasure. Some people might be surprised, perhaps, that I chose this match. There have been so many great ones I've seen. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was in the box. I don't know if you saw me of the Borg-McEnroe, and let's face it, of my closeness with Bjorn, you'd think I would choose that one. But no, there was something about this that set the world alight for me. I sat there transfixed the entire time. Mm. It was quite remarkable.
Well, I'm, for one, not surprised that you chose this match, Teddy, because I think there are a number of aspects to this match which hopefully we'll be able to talk about. Now, firstly, the match was played in Brisbane. An oddity with the Australian Open was that the venue changed from year to year. Now, I know that was something you were trying to rectify as part of the committee. As everyone knows, Brisbane, at that time of the year, the heat was absolutely oppressive, Teddy. Before the players walked onto court, I believe the temperature was already up into the high 30s, the early 40s.
Before we get on to that, Remo, I was on the committee to try and standardise the venue for the Australian Open. Mm. But in those days, it wasn't as professional as it is now.
No.
And some of the suggestions, I don't believe tennis should ever be played in a cattle yard. I just don't.
Not even an Australian Open.
Not even an Australian Open in those days. Very well said, because in those days it was quite, well, it was run by rabble. Mm. That was just rabble, that's all I can say. Mm. And all due respect to wonderful people, but rabble. Now, your question about heat. That was one of the hottest days I can remember, and yes, certainly the mercury could go higher in other days, but there was an intensity to this heat. It was like a blast furnace. I was there in a white flannel suit. There was a pool of sweat in my wooden seat. It was not comfortable for anybody, and I can't imagine how those two gladiators out on the court managed to provide such entertainment.
Yes, now, the heat, which was a major factor that day, led, I believe, to Rod Laver placing cabbage leaves into his Terry Towling hat to cool himself down. Now, can you verify if this is a true story?
Absolutely true. I saw it myself. In those days, they didn't really have changeovers as
no.
such. But on one of the occasions when they changed sides, I saw Rock reach into his little bag and pull out a cabbage leaf. And I thought, well, is he going to make himself some Lebanese food, perhaps? I wasn't sure. Rocket was unpredictable like that. He would give himself some sustenance in between points. I thought maybe he's going to chew on a cabbage leaf. Mm. Maybe he's going to roll a cabbage cigarette. I didn't know. Mm. Nobody did. And then he placed it under his hat. The woman next to me shouted out, he's gone crazy. She thought he'd lost his mind.
Well, yes.
And in those days, it was much more conservative than it is now, even if it was the 60s, much more conservative. So, yes, the cabbage leaf under the hat. Mm. I don't know if he ate it afterwards. It would have been well done.
No. Now, I believe Labor was on a vegetarian diet at the time, which is quite different to his opponent, Tony Roach, who was a crazy carnivore, was how you described him.
Oh, yes.
And in retaliation, Roach decided to place a slice of sirloin steak in his, which was, I found, absolutely fascinating, especially if we're talking about opposites, rivals. Now, this whole thing about Tony Roach playing the third set with a piece of meat placed in his hat now makes sense of the statement that he always used to say, I play best when the stakes are high, which now, of course, we all understand. But at the time, we didn't know what was going on there.
Well, Roach speaks in riddles at the best of times, but I think the problem wasn't that he put a sirloin steak under his hat. I think it was the actual type of steak, because it was rather bloody. And at about halfway through the set, I would say, blood was running down his forehead and his cheeks. Mixing with his sweat and dripping on the court. And Laver would change ends and look down at the court and say, well, what ho? What's going on here?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, what a sight. The next move from Laver, again in response to the heat, was to wear a handkerchief that he fashioned in a cravat scarf style, wet, of course, moistened, around his neck.
And what you don't know, Remo, is that before the match, I walked into the change rooms where the two good gentlemen were, and Rocket Rod came up to me and said, Teddy, do you have a handkerchief? And I laughed, of course, and said, well, don't be silly, Ron. I always have a handkerchief because you never know when you need one. I think it's a crime today that young people don't use handkerchiefs anymore.
Do they?
No. I have one with me now. Sometimes I have two. Sometimes I have two. Sometimes I keep one in my sock just in case. Now, I didn't know what he wanted the handkerchief for. He said to me, is it a large handkerchief, Teddy? And I said, well, it's a standard side, Rod. What are you after?
Well, rather a personal question, I would have thought.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, Rod was like that. Look, you know, the relationship between me and Rod was, you wouldn't call it close. We got on well.
Yeah.
Certainly closer than Stolly. He was a funny man, Rod, with his hankies and his cabbage leaves. And people thought he was one of the greats of all time. And I agree, obviously. But behind the scenes, there were some weird goings on, I've got to tell you.
Teddy, is there anything else that you would like to add? What made it great for you?
Well, you must remember this year was one of the most famous years in tennis history. Look at Rod Laver won the Grand Slam.
Yes.
People forget this, I think, or do they? No, they remember this. That's what I'm trying to say. They remember this, but they weren't there. I was there for all of it. I saw every final he ever played in that year. And it was sensational. Now, if he had lost this match, which he quite easily could have, let's face it, he lost the second last set, the fourth set, should I say, 6-1.
Yeah.
6-1.
Yeah.
There were murmurs around the crowd saying, Rod's lost it. No Grand Slam for you, Rod, someone shouted out. Sirloin's worked a treat. Take your cabbage back where you got it.
Well, we knew that, well, especially in Brisbane, that the Australian crowds
could
get a little unruly. After that match, you were unceremoniously dumped from the committee, the organising committee of the Australian Open. Can you tell us what happened?
They called me in. I walked in very slowly as if to my own execution. I knew what was coming. And they sat me down and said, Teddy, it has been a wonderful partnership so far. They were trying to butter me up a little bit, I suppose. And I looked up at them and I said, well, what have I done wrong, gents? And I said, it's not so much what you've done wrong, it's so much what you haven't done right. To this day, I have no idea what they were talking about. And they said, look, your suggestions, Teddy, to play the Australian Open on the tennis court. I said, where else are you going to play it? But they had ideas of their own. And I, well, I left. I held my head up with all the dignity I possibly could muster. I walked out of that room and unfortunately, the way out, I did trip and hit my head on the door handle, and there was some blood there. And I thought, well, no, that's a reflection of the match with Sirloin. I looked at them proudly and walked out. And I never went back to that committee.
No, and Australian tennis was the poorer for it.
Remo, we've talked about some of the ingredients that go into making some of the greatest matches of all time in tennis. We've talked about rivalry, the epic. We've talked about twists and turns. We've talked about the occasion.
Yeah.
We've talked about when they all come together.
Yeah, I'm all talked out.
I'm just about myself. But there's one thing we haven't talked about. The great leveler in tennis. One of the reasons we love this sport so much.
Do we really have to talk about this?
Yes. Okay. Let's do it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just very tired, but I'm with you.
This is the moment where they're not champions playing a match. They're just two ordinary schmoes. Can you call women schmoes?
Schmoet.
Just two ordinary? They're ordinary. Just two ordinary players playing a match. You switch on the telly, there it is, and suddenly, somehow, the catches fire. And you're involved and you're invested and you just loving every moment. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, doesn't it reignite your love for this wonderful game?
What is it, though? You really shouldn't have any interest, right? I think it's got something to do, almost as a primal level. It's the tempo. A tempo gets established between the two playing styles, regardless of who it is, that drags you in. There's something about that dynamic, about the two players, how one hits the ball and how the other returns it, that suits them and sets up something that makes it interesting. Am I being a bit vague here, Buzz?
No, I think that's a factor. I think another factor is sometimes, for whatever reason, the player's level of intent will meet as well.
Yeah.
There's not one that's better than the other, obviously, or has a lack of self-belief. They're just there and they want to win it. Their styles mesh. It's a bouillabaisse for the ages.
Beautiful. And really, just to end it, I guess the point we're making is whether you're fortunate enough to have centre court seats at a Grand Slam final, maybe watching an ageing number one player in the world taking on an up-and-coming number two player in the world that goes the distance, or if you're just peering through the back fence of the Mel Scranton Open, you see a couple of competitors going at it, tooth and nail. Enjoy. Hey, Buzzy Boy, how amazing is this? Never thought I'd see a Federer-Nadal US Open final.
I can't really talk right now.
The connection sounds weird. Where are you?
30-15.
Hold it. Is that you on the telly? Mate, are you umpiring the match?
Yeah, I should really go.
What an opportunity.
For what?
Slip something in about subscribing to the podcast.
Mate, I can't do that.
What's more important, off the frame or umpiring a Federer-Nadal US Open final?
I think you've just answered your own question. Hold on a second.
40-15. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't call out while the ball is in play. Also, please subscribe to the Off the Frame Tennis Podcast.
All right. Good one, man. But you forgot...
Yeah, I got it.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more thing. While Federer is reviewing the serve, could you please write an off-the-frame review on Apple Podcasts?
Buzz, that crowd doesn't sound too happy. Are they storming the court?
Hey, don't lock the chair.
Remo, tell your sister I love her.
I keep telling you, I don't have a sister.